And, of course, that music signifies it's birthday time here on Iris. On this March 26th, we are celebrating two birthdays, Christina East of Ankeny and Lorna Thompson of Rockwell. So very happy birthday to both Christina and Lorna. Sorry we couldn't give you better weather, but we hope you have a terrific birthday anyway. You're listening to Iowa Radio Television and Iowa PBS, and you're not a registered Iris user. Please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Deanna with today's obituary.
Thank you, Pat. We have just one listed here in the obituary page. Norma K. Thompson from Huxley. It is with great sadness that the family of K. Thompson, in parentheses it's Coral, must have been her maiden name, announced her passing on March 23rd. At the age of 86. A celebration of life will be held at 2:30 p.m. on Monday, April 1st at Trinity United Methodist Church in Huxley. Visitation will be held for 1 hour prior to the service at the church. The celebration will continue immediately following at the 1850 Homestead. A private family burial will be in the Ames Municipal Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Adams Funeral Home, and online condolences may be left for Kay's family at the AdamsSoderstrom.com website. In lieu of flowers, contributions can be made to the Trinity United Methodist Church in Huxley. That's all.
Thank you, Deanna. I'm going to finish reading the article I had just before birthdays about the abortion pill case in front of the Supreme Court. In addition to the legal action, the Conservative Heritage Foundation has put together a policy playbook in case Republicans retake the White House that includes ending mail-order abortions in violation of longstanding federal laws. David Cohen, a professor at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law, said, "They're really putting a lot into this because it's a workaround from having to actually pass an abortion ban, which they know they can't do." He considers the Comstock Act the most significant national threat to abortion rights through either a Supreme Court ruling or a second Trump administration. Banning abortion drugs from the mail wouldn't just keep women from directly receiving them, Cohen said. Drugs could also not be shipped to doctors. Neither could medical supplies or instruments needed for surgical abortions, he said. That interpretation could shut down all abortions. Julie Kay, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union Reproductive Freedom Project, said it's possible, though it would be surprising, for the court to signal that this zombie law from the 1880s can be used to ban all abortion without any involvement from Congress. In the Justice Department's briefs to the court, Solicitor General Elizabeth Perlogo reminded the justices that the appeals court decision they are reviewing did not address the Comstock Act. In this court, she added, should not either. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, on page 5 of the main section, the UN approves ceasefire resolution for Gaza. Netanyahu cancels delegation's D.C. trip after the U.S. abstains from the vote. This is from Joey Garrison and Francesca Chambers of USA Today. Dateline, Washington. The United Nations Security Council approved a resolution Monday demanding an immediate ceasefire in Israel's war in Gaza during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan and the unconditional release of all hostages from Gaza after the U.S. abstained from voting. The U.S., a steadfast ally of Israel during its war in Gaza, allowed the resolution to move forward by abstaining, making it the first ceasefire resolution to pass the Council since the Israel-Hamas war began. The 14 other member nations voted to approve the resolution. Efforts to pass similar ceasefire resolutions had failed 4 times, 3 vetoed by the Biden administration. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby told reporters shortly after the vote, "Our vote does not, and I repeat that, does not represent a shift in our policy." The abstention was met with strong resistance by the Israeli government. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced that Israel will no longer send a delegation that had planned to meet with Biden administration officials in Washington, D.C. this week as Israel moves toward a military operation in Rafah in southern Gaza. Kirby said of the full delegation, "It's certainly not ideal that they won't be coming to D.C., but he noted that Israel Defense Minister Yoav Gallant is already in Washington, and the White House has every expectation that Rafah will come up during their conversations. A veteran Israeli minister who joined Netanyahu's emergency unity government after Hamas's October 7th attack said Monday he had resigned after not being included in the highest-level war cabinet. Gideon Saar joined the unity government along with several other members of the opposition to help manage the war on Hamas in Gaza. Saar's departure, along with another of his allies, is not expected to affect the stability of Netanyahu's government, which still controls a clear majority in parliament. Saar was once a rival to Netanyahu in the right-wing Likud party before joining a more centrist bloc led by former military chief Benny Gantz. Together they entered the emergency government, and Gantz became a member of the small forum decision-making war cabinet while Saar was left out. Saar said in a broadcast remark, "I can't carry the responsibility if I do not have, in my judgment, a real possibility to influence the direction of policy. I simply do not see any benefit in this." His resignation did not come as a surprise, as Saar had broken up the alliance with Gantz earlier this month. So why did the U.S. abstain? Ramadan started March 10th and ends April 9th. Most recently, Russia and China had objected to a U.S.-led resolution Friday for an immediate and sustained ceasefire that also condemned Hamas for the deadly October 7th attack on Israel. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield cited the latest resolution's lack of language condemning Hamas as the primary reason the U.S. did not vote in its favor. She blamed Hamas for the failure to achieve a ceasefire agreement, which has been under negotiation for weeks. However, Thomas Greenfield said, "As I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution, and we believe it was important for the Council to speak out and make clear that our ceasefire, any ceasefire, must come with the release of all hostages." Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, applauded the action on the long-awaited resolution on Gaza that also emphasizes the urgent need to expand the flow of aid into Gaza. He said, "This resolution must be implemented. Failure would be unforgivable." He said, "It is absolutely essential to have a massive supply of humanitarian aid now." The Biden administration has become increasingly at odds with Netanyahu over efforts to get humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians. Netanyahu has refused Biden's demand for a two-state solution to the Middle East crisis and has pledged to continue the war in Gaza until Hamas is crushed. Rafah, the last refuge for about half of Gaza's 2.3 million population, after many people arrived in search of shelter after being displaced by fighting elsewhere, came under heavy fire in the latest Israeli attacks, witnesses said. Palestinian medics said 30 people had been killed in the previous 24 hours in Rafah, where Israel is planning a ground assault to eliminate what it says are Palestinian militant cells there. Abu Khaled, a father of seven who declined to give his full name for fear of reprisals, said, "The past 24 hours were one of the worst days since we moved into Rafah." He said, "We live in fear. We are hungry. We are homeless. And our future is unknown. With no ceasefire in sight, we might end up dead or displaced somewhere else, maybe north and maybe south to Egypt." Dozens of Palestinians took part in rallies and attended funerals early on Monday after an Israeli airstrike killed 18 Palestinians in one house in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza, medics and witnesses said. Israeli forces were also besieging Al-Amal and Nasser hospitals in the southern city of Khan Yunis, Palestinian witnesses said, a week after entering Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, the main hospital in the Gaza Strip. U.S.-backed mediation by Qatar and Egypt has so far failed to secure agreement on a ceasefire and prisoner hostage swap between Israel and Hamas, and international concerns about famine are increasing. Guterres said it in Jordan, "We see a growing consensus emerging in the international community to tell the Israelis that the ceasefire is needed." Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere, heat records alarm scientists in 2024. Meteorologists are not sure why the temperatures are so high. Dinah Voiles-Pulver of USA Today wrote this article. Nearly 3 months into the new year, 2024 is carrying on where 2023 ended, with a litany of broken weather records that include higher air temperatures, warmer oceans, and higher tides. For 9 months in a row, each month has set new heat records. That leaves the world's weather organizations and scientists concerned about the degree to which things continue to be so much warmer than normal and searching for reasons to explain why that is the case. Last week, as the United Nations World Meteorological Organization released its annual report for 2023, Secretary General Celeste Saulou said, "It's sounding the red alert to the world. Never have we been so close, albeit on a temporary basis at the moment, to the 1.5 Celsius lower limit of the Paris Agreement's on climate change." Both January and February this year were the warmest on record for the respective months of the year, making 9 consecutive months of record warmth, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration reported. In February, the global average temperature was 3.18 degrees Celsius. That's 1.77 above the estimated pre-industrial average, according to Copernicus Climate Change Service, the European Union's Earth Observation Program. The global average temperature was the highest on record for the 12-month period ending in February. It was more than 1.2 degrees over the 30-year average for 1991 to 2020 and 2.8 degrees, 1.56 Celsius, over the estimated pre-industrial average. Although these global averages are above the 1.5 Celsius 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit threshold set in the Paris Agreement, it's not yet seen as exceeding the goal because that is based on a long-term consistent average rather than a measurement from any single month or year. Still, it's cause for alarm, UN officials said. Sirens are blaring across all major indicators, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said. Some records aren't just chart-topping, they're chart-busting, and changes are speeding up. It's normal for some weather records to be broken. What isn't so normal is the proportion of them related to warmer temperatures or the degree to which the new records shatter previous records by a long shot. For example, in Qualaut, Washington, earlier this month, a weather station reported a daily record high of 80 degrees, smashing its previous record for the day by 16 degrees, according to the National Weather Service in Seattle. Scientists continue to be astonished and alarmed by warmer temperatures across the world's oceans between the 60-degree latitude lines. Andrew Pershing, who's the vice president for science at Climate Central, said, "We still don't quite know exactly what's driving that, and that's worrisome to just have this big of a signal in the ocean. We expect the oceans to be warmer, but this is really, really significant." On March 10th, the globe's daily average sea surface temperature briefly jumped to a new record high of 70.16 degrees Fahrenheit, according to a chart kept by the Maine Climate Reanalyzer using NOAA data. Brian McNulty, a senior research associate at the Rosenthal School of Marine Atmospheric and Earth Science at the University of Miami, said, "We're now at 1 year and counting of shattering the previous records for ocean heat. According to model projections," he said, "the warmer than normal ocean temperatures look likely to continue over the next few months in the North Atlantic. The temperature anomaly is even higher in the region of the Atlantic where most major hurricanes develop. For the first 2 months of the year, water temperatures in the region averaged nearly 3 degrees above normal over the previous century, blowing past a record previously set in 2010 by a full degree, according to NOAA. That's NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Given a potential La Nina pattern in the Pacific and the hotter ocean waters, it doesn't bode well for the Atlantic hurricane season that begins June 1st. What stands out to Pershing about this winter was the scope of the warming in the upper Midwest. If you're somebody who grew up around the Great Lakes or you grew up in that kind of icy and snowy conditions in Wisconsin and Minnesota, that just was gone this year, and that's a huge change, he said, both psychologically and economically. The three-month meteorological winter that ended February 29th was the warmest on record for the globe in the contiguous United States, according to NOAA. The agency noted that 8 states saw their warmest winter on record: Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New York, North Dakota, Vermont, and Wisconsin, and 26 others had one of their top 10 warmest winters. Copernicus director Carlo Buttentempo said, "February joins the long streak of records of the last few months. As remarkable as this might appear, it is not really surprising, as the continuous warming of the climate system inevitably leads to new temperature extremes. The average temperature in the United States in February was 37.6 degrees, and that is 5.5 degrees above average. The lower 48 states saw the third warmest February on record, with an average temperature of 41.1 degrees, and that's 7.2 degrees above the 20th century average. Meanwhile, the global average ocean temperature for February was 1.8 degrees above last century's average, almost 0.4 of a degree higher than the previous record temperature anomaly for the month, and that was set in 2016. Scientists don't fully understand why temperatures are up so much more than projected. NASA climate scientist Gavin Schmidt wrote last week in the journal Nature, "It's humbling and a bit worrying to admit that no year has confounded climate scientists despite predictive capabilities more than 2023 has." In general, the 2023 temperature anomaly has come out of the blue, revealing an unprecedented knowledge gap since satellites began offering comprehensive views of the Earth's climate system, he said. If the anomaly does not stabilize by August, a reasonable expectation based on previous El Niño events, then the world will be in uncharted territory. He closed with this: "We need answers for why 2023 turned out to be the warmest year in possibly the past 100,000 years, and we need them quickly." Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. On the following page, out of Moscow, Macron says IRIS is responsible for Russia concert attack. France on Monday joined the United States in saying intelligence indicated that the Islamic State was responsible for an attack on a concert hall outside Moscow that killed 137 people, while Russia continued to suggest that Ukraine was to blame. In the deadliest attack inside Russia in 2 decades, 4 men burst into the Crocus City Hall Friday night, spraying people with bullets during a concert by Soviet-era rock group Picnic. Alongside the dead, 182 were wounded. 4 men, at least one Tajik, were remanded in custody on terrorism charges. They appeared separately, led into a cage at Moscow's Basmany District Court by Federal Security Service officers. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, a claim that the United States has publicly said it believes, and the militant group has since released what it says is footage from the attack. U.S. officials said they had warned Russia of intelligence about an imminent attack earlier this month. It said, "The information available to us as well as to our main partners indicates indeed that it was an entity of the Islamic State which instigated this attack," said French President Emmanuel Macron, referring to the Islamic State's affiliate in Afghanistan known as ISIS-Khorasan or ISIS-K. "This group also tried to commit several actions on our own soil," he said during a visit to French Guiana. France raised its terror alert to its highest level on Sunday following the shooting at Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin has not publicly mentioned the Islamic militant group in connection with the attackers who he said had been trying to escape to Ukraine. Putin said some people on the Ukrainian side had been prepared to spirit the gunmen across the border. Ukraine has denied any role in the attack, and President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Putin of seeking to divert blame for the attack by mentioning Ukraine, something Macron said was a mistake. He added, "I think that it would be both cynical and counterproductive for Russia itself and the security of its citizens to use this context to try and turn it against Ukraine." He added that France had offered cooperation to help find the culprits. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova earlier called into question U.S. assertions that the Islamic State, which once sought control over swaths of Iraq and Syria, was behind the attack. Two U.S. officials said on Friday that the United States had intelligence confirming that the Islamic State's claim of responsibility. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that Russia could not comment on the Islamic State claim while the investigation was ongoing and would not comment on the U.S. intelligence, saying it was sensitive information. Putin said 11 people had been detained, including the four suspected gunmen who he said had fled the concert hall and made their way to the Bryansk region, about 210 miles southwest of Moscow, to slip across the border to Ukraine. Pat, back to you.
Thank you, Dana. Let's turn now to the 50 states report from USA Today. This is a section, just kind of a brief highlight from all the states around the United States. And the highlighted state in this day's report is Pennsylvania. In York, Pennsylvania, lettuce, radishes, and other vegetables are growing in three temperature-controlled greenhouses, technically called high tunnels, that sit on the campus of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center Memorial in West Manchester Township. It marks the first planting for the farm-to-hospital program aimed at offering fresh food to help fight the root causes of illnesses such as heart and renal diseases and to support healthy women and babies. It's paired with fitness, mindfulness, and spiritual healing, and it's project led by Dr. Kimberly Mudge, lead surgical associates. From Alabama, Montgomery, Governor Kay Ivey and legislative leadership unveiled a slate of seven bipartisan bills called the Working for Alabama Package that aims to support and increase workforce development throughout the state. Anchorage, Alaska, the former director of the Anchorage Health Department has agreed to pay $30,000 to settle a lawsuit brought against him by the state of Alaska. From Phoenix, the Kopaka tribe and two other Arizona tribal communities are working with new money and tools to address climate change after receiving grants from the U.S. Department of the Interior. Fort Smith, Arkansas, the path of the upcoming April 8th total eclipse stretches from eastern Texas to Ohio, and the center line across Arkansas includes areas in the Washita National Forest southeast of Fort Smith. The Arkansas Division of Elementary and Secondary Education reports the state expects hundreds of thousands of visitors on April 8th for the Great North American Eclipse. In Palm Springs, the Desert Care Network there, which encompasses three hospitals, has donated $2.5 million to DAP Health to aid its Vision Forward campus expansion and upcoming affordable housing complex, Vista Sunrise. From Denver, Colorado, the clock is ticking on whether Colorado's released wolves will breed and have pups this spring. Wolf breeding season starts in mid-February around Valentine's Day, well, that's appropriate, with pups born starting in mid-April. Colorado Parks and Wildlife officials said the GPS collars placed on the 10 wolves when they were released in Grand and Summit counties in late December will give them clues as if and when the state might expect pups this spring. From Norwich, Connecticut, while Norwich has a walkable urban form, only 2-3% of trips downtown are taken by foot or bike, according to a presentation given this month. Draft plans from the Downtown Mobility Study aim to change this. From Wilmington, Delaware, things are moving along with Delaware's future as a hydrogen producer for the Mid-Atlantic region, to the dismay of community members and environmental advocates. Concrete details are still unconfirmed, but the future of the hydrogen economy is beginning to take shape, and the state of Delaware is set to be a big part. From our nation's capital, Ronna McDaniel, who resigned from her role as the chair of the Republican National Committee earlier this month, has joined NBC News as a political analyst. In Gainesville, Florida, the University of Florida announced it will adopt an early action plan for potential first-year students on its applications starting this year. From Savannah, Georgia, investigations of four deaths of Chatham County Detention Center inmates remain unresolved pending a final decision from the Chatham County District Attorney's Office, according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. In Honolulu, Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources officials said that a popular forest reserve and trail will reopen on April 1st after being closed for 7 months due to damage caused by wildfire and high winds. In Boise, Idaho, a man there was sentenced to 1 year in prison for his role in a $1.5 million grass seed fraud scheme while he supervised the company's Albany, Oregon operations. From our neighboring state of Illinois and Springfield, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin has authored a letter to President Joe Biden urging him to employ his authority under the Antiquities Act to create a national monument in honor of Springfield native and philanthropist Julius Rosenwald. And from Indiana, in Indianapolis, more people left Marion County last year than anywhere else in the state, but continued suburban growth has pushed the Indianapolis metropolitan area's estimated population to nearly 2.14 million people. And now Deanna with Iowa, I think.
Mm-hmm. Out of Des Moines. A long-awaited Iowa Attorney General's audit of victim services, blamed for a year-long pause on payments for sexual assault victims' emergency contraceptives and abortions, is hung up with senior staff who haven't signed off on its release, the Des Moines Register has learned. Out of Topeka, Kansas, Kansas public education officials are nearing the final steps of updating the high school graduation requirements that have been in place since before current students were born. The proposed new requirements would put a greater emphasis on science, technology, engineering, and math, known as STEM, while also adding requirements for a financial literacy class and out-of-classroom experiences. From Louisville, Kentucky, the affordable housing shortage is getting worse for Louisville's lowest income residents, despite an increase in available homes, according to a new report. The city is now short about 36,000 units affordable to residents with extremely low incomes, an increase of about 5,000 homes since officials last studied the need. From Shreveport, Louisiana, Shreveport University is hitting record highs in enrollment. Louisiana State University Shreveport announced that the university has crossed the 10,000 mark in enrollment for the first time in the school's history. Spring enrollment is up to 10,214. Out of Wells in Maine, members of the Wells Select Board voted unanimously this month to have the town attorney draft a retroactive moratorium that would halt large-scale residential developments in the community for 180 days. Across the country, in Hagerstown, Maryland, a state bill key to the growth of the Washington County community, designed to study Washington County's water and wastewater needs, has been put on hold this year, according to a senator who sponsored it. And out of Cumaquid, Massachusetts, in the tidal flats bordering the beach at Mass Audubon's Long Pasture Wildlife Sanctuary, a ritual that predates the dinosaurs will soon begin. Next month, Atlantic horseshoe crabs will begin to make their way to the shoreline here and all over the Cape to spawn. And this year, the event that peaks in May 11th will take place without disturbances from harvesters, now that the Marine Fisheries Advisory Commission has adopted new regulations giving more protections to the crustaceans. Out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, Ann Arbor Public Schools must cut $25 million from its budget for the next school year, which will mean layoffs at the district, according to the interim superintendent. And out of St. Paul, Minnesota, Democratic Governor Tim Walz and Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan were joined by library professionals, students, and legislators at Como Park Senior High School in St. Paul on Thursday to highlight legislation that would prohibit the banning of books in public schools. Pat, back to you.
Okay, we got time for just a couple more. In Jackson, Mississippi, the city of Jackson is facing at least 24 lawsuits due to city employees being involved in vehicular crashes with city-owned vehicles, with one striking and killing a pedestrian. And at our bordering state of Missouri, in St. Louis, a two-headed rat snake on a statewide tour to show off how special she is, recovering after recently undergoing surgery at a Missouri zoo. In a post on the Missouri Department of Conservation's website, naturalist Lauren Baker said the snake sneezed up traces of blood during a recent feeding. Well, for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Pat Steele and Deanna Snyder. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow Doug and Scott to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Doug Kretzinger and Scott Splavik. We're going to continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. And here's Scott with our next article.
I'll start with the opinion page from the USA Today. And our first opinion is entitled Pandemic Politics Stole Under 30 Happiness. It's written by Sarah Pequeño of the USA Today. Young people in the United States aren't happy. At least, that's what the takeaway from this year's World Happiness Report. The annual analysis by Gallup, the United Nations, and more ranked the United States as number 23, knocking the country out of the top 20 for the first time ever. It's apparently all thanks to the folks under age 30. When they're the only ones accounted for, the country falls to 62 in the rankings. As someone who is under 30, I'm not surprised in the slightest. In the 2021 to 2023 period, we have experienced huge life changes amid a pandemic, a new president, and persistent economic anxiety. We collectively aren't okay. The happiness scores come from six criteria: GDP per capita, social support, healthy life expectancy, freedom, generosity, and corruption. Despite the large-scale criteria, I have some ideas as to why people my age are unhappier than older folks in the United States. One of the biggest sources of unhappiness for people my age has been the aftermath of COVID-19. Think about it. For those of us entering adulthood 4 years ago, the before and after of the pandemic has been drastic. Some of these young people finished high school or college during COVID-19. Others were just starting their careers. Suddenly, we all had to confront the reality of disease, of isolation, and of government incompetence. Then, we had to confront death. Nearly 1.2 million people have died of COVID-19 since the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention began tracking cases in 2020. Then came the economic ramifications. A USA Today analysis of Medicaid data revealed a 17% increase in Zoloft prescriptions from 2019 to 2022, and a 12% increase in mental health drug prescriptions overall. Groceries got more expensive, student loan payments restarted after a three-year pause, the cost of renting increased 15% between 2020 and 2022, and Redfin data from 2023 showed a 44% increase in the country's median home price since January of 2020. For people under age 30, these financial stressors hit during a coming-of-age period that is defined by the very things that went upside down. Conversely, there also have been increases in youth suicide and homicide rates since the start of the pandemic. These deaths also affect the emotional well-being of everyone in the victim's immediate network. Everyone went through the pandemic. The fact that it hit at such a specific time, when so many of us were transitioning to adulthood, made it difficult, and the after is still being felt. One of the other reasons young people in the United States may be feeling down is the loss of a right that our parents had, the right to an abortion nationwide. That is something that has disproportionately affected young women in particular, to the point that it will be a deciding factor come the November elections. According to KFF, formerly Kaiser Family Foundation, 1 in 8 voters now say abortion is the most important to their vote. Last year, Gallup polling showed that nearly half of 18 to 29-year-olds want legal abortion under any circumstances, and that 41% say it should be legal under certain circumstances. Aside from the loss of Roe v. Wade, we're also in an election year. Right now, it feels like political polarization is at an all-time high because we are being inundated with rhetoric. Everywhere you turn, political ads are reminding us of what is at stake this election, the reality of 4 more years of former President Donald Trump and the antics, or 4 more years of President Joe Biden and traditional Democratic politics despite the desire for something more. A lot of this bubbles to the surface on social media, which already has proved to have negative effects on mental health. For me, using platforms like X and Instagram either leads to doom scrolling or a never-ending feed of consumer culture, people telling me what to buy, whether they're influencers or not, or advertisers. The solution to this, of course, is for us to use social media less. But that's easier said than done when there are so many of us who rely on social media to grow our professional network, find new clients, or simply to keep up with our friends. Maybe it's easier for people who grew up without social media to give it up. It's harder for us who grew up through social media to see a world without it, even if it might make us happier. The over 60 crowd in the United States seems much happier than their younger counterparts. The country ranks 10th in the World Happiness Report when only that demographic is counted. Obviously, something has made their lives more bearable. They might be closer to paying off debts or close to the possibility of retirement. Maybe it's their marriage or children. Or maybe they're all fibbing and actually feel dreadful. I'm jealous of the joy that baby boomers and the silent generation apparently possess. Or maybe the reality is that things are, in fact, not okay. We have lived through unprecedented times for the past few years, and now we're seeing the aftermath. It's not really surprising that young people aren't as happy as the rest of you. Just don't expect us to grin and bear it, please.
Country chews poorly, so I'm not voting for Trump or Biden, is our next opinion. It's written by Dace POTUS, who is an opinion fellow for USA Today, a graduate from DePaul University with a degree in political science. He's also president of the Lone Conservative, the largest conservative student-run publication in the country. Shortly after Nikki Haley dropped out of the Republican presidential primary on March 6, I wrote a column stating that, though I'm a conservative, I won't vote for either Donald Trump or Joe Biden. Despite dozens of furious emails proclaiming that I am not a real conservative, that I am some secret Democrat or encouraging me to vote Biden, I have not changed my mind. However, I think that one argument is worth addressing. Many people read the column and told me that every vote is valuable, and that my choice to not vote is throwing away my vote or my right to have my voice heard. We are unbelievably lucky in America to have a vote that actually matters. That is something I do not take for granted. As much as people like to incorrectly claim that our elections are somehow rigged, we do not live in Vladimir Putin's Russia, where he recently received a staggering 87% of the vote in an election devoid of any meaningful opposition. Why would I vote for somebody I do not believe should lead us? I understand why my willingness to discard that voting right is off-putting to many. It's something I wrestled with for years as a hypothetical scenario that has become a dreadful reality. My thought process is simple. I cannot, in good conscience, vote for Biden, who has entirely neglected his duty as president to secure the border and has weaponized the Department of Justice against pro-lifers, alongside countless other abuses of power and failed policies. At the same time, Trump is an unacceptable candidate due to his actions as president in the fallout of the January 6, 2021 riot, his refusal to debate other GOP candidates, and his self-admitted history of abusing women. Why would anybody vote for these candidates? Rather than choose to vote for someone I think is unfit for office, I would prefer to use my vote to tell the major political parties that they have failed. I hope other conservatives join me. Our choice to vote in other 2024 races, while ignoring the presidency, would send a clear message that earning the White House requires a candidate worthy of it. We can still vote in state elections that matter. We criticize Democrats for voting for the Weekend at Bernie's candidate, Biden. But we also need to have standards, even if that means potentially losing an election to prove that point. One quarter of Generation Z is reluctant to vote for either Trump or Biden. People from my age crave normalcy when it comes to candidate selection and had a chance to capitalize on that desire. While Gen Z does skew heavily toward the left, such a significant portion of us not being sold on Biden shows a missed opportunity by Republicans who only had to nominate a candidate capable of capturing moderate voters. Our best course of action as a generation is to not choose the lesser of two evils, but rather show the two major political parties that our votes could have been won had they chosen different candidates. While I personally would be very unlikely to vote for anyone the Democrats could nominate for president, much of my generation is ready to jump on board, especially when the alternative is Trump. As for Republicans, we should not fall victim to the lie that the fate of the country is at stake with this election. That rhetoric is helpful for rallying voters, but is dishonest. Our country will survive Biden's first disastrous presidency, and it can survive another 4 years. Our country survived Trump's fruitless attempts to retain power after he lost the presidency in 2020, and it would survive a second term of his as well. Presidents do not determine the fate of our country, as much as doomsayers on both sides like to forecast. The fate of America is not at stake in this specific election, but rather in all future elections. If America's two major political parties continue to offer disastrous candidates, then America will remain in political distress. My choice to not vote for Trump or Biden is one that is rooted in concern for the future, not the tales of imminent doomsday the pundits forecast.
Thank you, Doug. Now it's time to turn to the sports page, and we'll start with what's on TV today. And this has got to be the shortest list of sports on TV today that I've seen in quite a while. At 6:30 p.m., we've got NHL on ESPN Plus and Hulu, New Jersey at Toronto. And at 9 p.m. on ESPN Plus and Hulu, it's Columbus at Arizona. In the NBA, 6:30 p.m. on TNT, it's Los Angeles Lakers at Milwaukee. And at 9 p.m. on TNT, it's Dallas at Sacramento. And then there's a few MLB preseason games today. First at 1:05 p.m. on the MLB Network, it's Boston at Texas. At 2:05 p.m. on ESPN Plus and the MLB Network, it's the St. Louis Cardinals at the Chicago Cubs. And at 8 p.m. on the MLB Network, it's the LA Dodgers versus the LA Angels. Now I'll read the top story on the sports page today, and it's entitled, Drake Coach DeVries Leaves for West Virginia Job. It's written by Alyssa Hartle of the Des Moines Register. The Darren DeVries era, one filled with growth, stabilization, and success, is over at Drake. DeVries, the Bulldogs' men's basketball coach, will depart the relatively flat lands of Des Moines for the Appalachian Mountains of West Virginia, ending the tenure of one of the school's most beloved coaches. West Virginia and Drake confirmed DeVries' hiring on Sunday evening. The litmus test for any employee that departs a place of employment is, did they leave it better than they found it, Drake Director of Athletics Brian Harden said in a news release. It is easy to say that Darren DeVries has left our men's basketball program and our athletics department in incredible positions thanks to his 6 years at Drake. Darren led the Drake men's basketball team to new heights on the court while establishing an elite culture off the court. He was an incredible mentor to the men in our men's basketball program for the last 6 years and a wonderful representative of our department. We are grateful to Darren for his leadership and wish him the best in his next journey. Marty Richter will serve as the interim head coach effective immediately. In 6 seasons with the Bulldogs, from 2018 to 2024, DeVries compiled a 150-win, 55-loss overall record, including a 28-7 record this year. Drake won 20 or more games in each season under DeVries. DeVries' departure comes on the heels of a 66-61 loss to Washington State in the first round of the NCAA tournament last week. DeVries led Drake to March Madness 3 times during his tenure in 2021, 2023, and 2024. Two of those appearances were automatic bids after winning the Missouri Valley Conference titles in consecutive seasons 2023 and 2024. Harden met with members of the media during an impromptu press conference at 9 p.m. Sunday. Certainly a bittersweet day, Harden said, of losing the team's successful coach. Kind of knew that this could come at some point, but that doesn't make it any easier, personally or professionally, to see Darren leave. He came in and exceeded all of our expectations in terms of what he was capable of being the head men's basketball coach at Drake University. Harden hired DeVries in 2018, a little over 100 days after Harden had taken the job as Drake's athletic director. On Sunday, he expressed his appreciation for the impact DeVries had not only on the men's basketball program, but also on the university and the Des Moines community. Harden shared that DeVries was open about coaching opportunities that popped up, and it was part of DeVries' contract that he had to ask permission to talk to other schools. Harden's interactions with West Virginia Athletics Director Ren Baker occurred on Friday, one day after Drake was eliminated from the NCAA tournament. I've known Ren Baker for a number of years, actually longer than I've known Darren, Harden said. Ren called on Friday and wanted to get my thoughts. Darren deserved the opportunity to talk with Ren about his position, and I'm not surprised that Ren has offered him this opportunity. DeVries signed an 8-year contract extension with the Bulldogs in 2021. Harden confirmed that there was a buyout clause or a penalty for DeVries' early departure in his contract, but declined to disclose the amount. Harden will turn his attention to finding the next head coach of the men's basketball program. The news of DeVries leaving led to instant roster activity. Drake's Atten Wright, Kevin Overton, and Connor Enright announced Monday that they would enter the portal. But even with the possibility of a major roster shakeup following DeVries' departure, Harden plans to take as much time as needed to find the right fit. Harden plans to evaluate candidates based on a list of criteria. He met with current players and plans to have individual meetings as requested to determine what players want in a head coach. The Drake Athletic Director shared that he will start his search looking for candidates with energy, passion, and vision. Most important, though, Harden wants a candidate who wants to be the head coach at Drake. "I'm not going to rush the hire just because of that," Harden said. "The portal works both ways. Folks go, folks come. The important thing is that we get the right person in here. We need to move quickly, but I don't want to hurry so fast that we end up hiring the wrong person." Before DeVries arrived at Drake, the Bulldogs experienced a bit of a coaching carousel. The Bulldogs went through three head coaches, Ray Giacoletti, Jeff Rutter, who was an interim, and Nico Medved, between 2014 and 2018. DeVries was one of the longest tenured coaches in Drake history and the first to coach the Bulldogs for more than five seasons since Kurt Kanaski from 1997 to 2003. Of Drake's coaches during the 21st century, DeVries is only the second coach to put together a winning career record at the school. Keno Davis went 28-5 in his single season in Des Moines. Medved went 17-17 in 1 year with the Bulldogs. DeVries produced several successful players during his time at Drake, none better than his son, Tucker DeVries. The younger DeVries consistently rose to the top of the MVC and was named the conference's Player of the Year in back-to-back years. Tucker DeVries has a year of college eligibility remaining.
Iowa State women's season ends with NCAA loss to Stanford, written by Tommy Birch. Get through part of it here. Not many people, at least outside of the Iowa State women's basketball team's locker room, expected the rebuilding Cyclones to do much this season. Iowa State and its roster full of freshmen surprised teams across the country with their run to the Big 12 Conference Tournament title game and at large bid to the NCAA tournament. That surprise season came to an end Sunday night as two-seed Stanford held off 7-seed Iowa State 87-81 in overtime in an NCAA tournament second-round game at Maples Pavilion. Iowa State finished its season with a 21-12 mark and was a play or two away from delivering a monumental upset. The Cyclones gave Stanford all it could handle and then some. "Nobody thought we were going to be anything, let's be honest. And here we are going into overtime with Stanford," said Iowa State freshman Audie Cooks. "Are you kidding me?" Iowa State point guard Emily Ryan poured in a career-high 36 points and grabbed 9 rebounds for the Cyclones, who led 33-31 at halftime and were tied with Stanford heading into the fourth quarter. The back-and-forth battle included 18 lead changes and 12 ties. Cyclones led late in fourth quarter and in overtime, but Iowa State couldn't finish the job against a Stanford squad that got a game-high 41 points from Kiki Irifin. "They have a lot of talent on their team, and she had one of those nights tonight," Ryan said. "There wasn't much we could do to stop her. Every time we tried to do something, she countered it with strong move or something different." Despite the huge night from Irifin, I'm not sure I'll pronounce that right, and with Crooks, Iowa State's biggest scoring star, battling foul trouble most of the night, Iowa State refused to go away. So while the end was a disappointment for the Cyclones, there was still plenty to be happy about in a season full of surprising moments. It ends by Fenley saying, "I haven't had this much fun coaching in a long time." And that's the end of the Iowa Cyclones girls basketball team for this year.
Now we'll go to Dear Abby. And it's entitled, "Parents Has Chosen to Keep Relatives at Arm's Length." Dear Abby, I grew up in a big lower class family in which there has always been drama, fights, gossip, etc. I made a vow to myself that when I had my own family, I would raise them better. I keep myself and my children distanced from all of that. Am I wrong for keeping them away from my family? I don't like drama or problems. Sometimes I miss my family, but after a while, I get overwhelmed. Signed, Separate in Chicago. Abby says, "Dear Separate, as a parent, your responsibility is to protect your children. If you feel exposing them to something might be harmful, you are within your rights to keep them away. However, if you are raising your children in a healthy environment, exposing them to your family drama in limited doses isn't likely to be harmful. Afterward, if your relatives behaved badly, use it as a teaching moment. Use them as a bad example and point out that in your family, you do not behave that way." And our second letter is, "Dear Abby, I am a single man who recently turned 40. I'm looking to find a wife who, like myself, has never been married and has no kids. I joined several dating websites, but most of the women are divorced or widowed or have kids. I just discovered a new dating website for single, never married people. I'm not sure if I should join it, but having a website designed for people like me is a great idea. I have read that 25% of all Americans have never been married. Pew Research just reported a brand new poll, and millions of Americans have never been married. So I am not losing hope. Should I join? Signed, Contemplating in Florida." Dear Contemplating, by all means, explore that new dating site. When you do, expect to meet women who are considerably younger than you. Remember, however, that once you connect, you will have to take all of the precautions that people on other sites do to ensure that you do not get misled. Dating, regardless of how you meet someone, can be risky. I wish you luck." And one final letter, "Dear Abby, I have a neighbor who lives across the street. She's in her late 70s. We've been friendly until recently when she came to visit with me for coffee. We talked about many different things that day. She had brought me a present and homemade cookies, which was nice. When I mentioned something that apparently she didn't like or believe, she stood up, announced that she didn't come over to feel uncomfortable, and left in a huff. I emailed her and sent a handwritten apology, but she hasn't spoken to me since. What should I do with her unopened gift and cookies? I don't feel comfortable accepting them. Signed, Dazed and Confused." Dear Dazed and Confused, how sad that your neighbor wasn't able to tell you what it was you said that made her so uncomfortable she felt she had to end the relationship. Perhaps you could have straightened it out at that time. However, her decision seems to have been made and you will have to accept it. Because you now feel uncomfortable accepting them, return her gift and the cookies.
Thank you, Scott. And before we wrap it up here, a little weather update for you. 38 is the high today. It's kind of chilly out there. Low is going to be 22. It's windy and colder today with a bit of snow. Well, winds northwest 20 to 30 miles an hour, partly cloudy tonight. Winds go down to 8 to 16. Tomorrow, high of 47, mostly sunny tomorrow. Look forward to that. Low will be 29. Thursday, high will be 61, low of 43. Friday about the same. Saturday about the same. Sunday about the same, and it looks like it's going to be just fine for the rest of the week. Folks, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Doug Kretzinger. My partner at the microphone has been Scott Splavik. Earlier, you heard Pat Steele and Deanna Snyder. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. I want to thank you for listening to IRIS, today's Iowa's first and only radio reading service, and I hope you have a good day.